This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this special CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Xuan Chan, Head of ESG, LGIM Real Assets, and Madeline King, Co-Head of Global Investment Grade Research. Well, we're devoting the entirety of today's session to discussing what COP26 means for investors. The UN Climate Conference in Glasgow ended with a last-minute agreement over the weekend, but of course, the task of putting those words into action is only just beginning. So with no further ado, Sonia, in addition to that final announcement, there were a flurry of other commitments from countries and companies. Which were the most important for investors?
Yes, absolutely, Max. It's fair to say that this was probably the most publicly known and accessed COP of all. It's the 26th edition ever since the inaugural session in Berlin in 1995. And we've had global leaders from 120 countries and more than 30,000 people attending. So clearly, I haven't found exactly whether it was the largest, but it feels like clearly, in terms of public attention, it probably is one of the most hotly expected events in a long time. Now, before going into more detail in terms of some of the announcement, it is probably worth understanding as well what was not said. We definitely were not short of high-level announcements. We had pledges and promises and clearly a lot of attention on the detail. But within all this, it is important to understand from investors that not all these that these pledges and promises not necessarily carry binding commitments that are enforceable. And this is clearly, if you think about the planning horizon, if we think about the clarity of the pathways, that is something that clearly has been missing. And probably the most high profile of these missing binding agreements were China and India, who in a last minute attempt removed the binding commitments on exiting coal. So clearly something, and there's a lot to digest, and we probably do not have all full implications yet, but that clearly is something that we will be looking towards how this can potentially be put right in the future. The second area I wanted to highlight of something that clearly market participants were focusing a lot on is the price of carbon. There has not been a meaningful step towards a global carbon pricing system, nor the agreement or the understanding of the necessity of potentially a carbon tax. And I will come to this later, but clearly, in order to quantify the problem and incentivize carbon consumers and producers, that to our mind is an incredibly important ingredient in our path to net zero. Last but not least, and this is something again that we have talked about in the past, is around measurement and fairness of the transition. And let me talk to both of them individually, because measurement in particular, we know that a lot of countries put forward plans to achieve net zero by 2050, but very often these are done based on the territorial carbon production rather than the carbon consumption. What I mean by this is, let's assume I'm importing a product from overseas, then clearly I'm not counting for the embedded carbon in this product in my overall carbon footprint, which I think from a fairness point of view, we should, because we are actually we are causing the carbon to be emitted. So very important, lots of talk about this. And I think when it comes to the fairness point, this will clearly be something that will be discussed further in the future. The other point around fairness, and this was very much in the center again, was obviously between developed and developing nations. It was particularly the Minister for Energy of India who put forward that obviously it is unfair that developing nations, and India included, cannot enjoy the very fossil fuel and carbon heavy industrial revolution that we've seen over the past 100 years, enjoyed obviously by Europe, the US and other developed countries. So it's this fairness of overall carbon that we have emitted over the time compared to obviously countries like India and China that are really just at the beginning of that journey and say, yes, you want us to transition, but if I look at the overall carbon you've emitted already, the damage you've done far outstrips what we are doing. And again, I think we would have hoped a bigger step towards understanding this problem and addressing it. And again, I think from an investor's point of view, if you put it all together, it just shows that the problem statement is truly global in nature. Getting to a real outcome requires collaboration that probably we haven't seen to the extent we would like to see. One of the very high profile announcements is around deforestation. So we have seen quite a number of countries signing up to ending and phasing out deforestation by 2030. Again, we probably need to see the detail in terms of the binding commitments and what is in there, but that clearly was a very high profile level that got a lot of attention. And although I have to say when I went through the detail, the total amount of private and public funding proposed to tackle deforestation is less than what the UK has spent on the track and trace system during COVID, right? It's always important to put it in perspective of what kind of numbers we're talking about, given the significance and the global nature of the problem. One final point, regulation, because again, keenly anticipated from an investor's point of view, we always said we need greater harmonization of how we measure, how we establish a framework for tackling climate change. And so the formation of the new International Sustainability Standards Board clearly is a step in the right direction. Again, obviously the devil is in the detail and we will need to see what will how this will be taken forward. But I think from our point of view, that's clearly an important one.
Right. Well, so some progress, much more work remains to be done, and very big questions for investors and other market participants. Xuan, let's turn to you now. Of course, you were there in Glasgow. Can you give us a flavour of what COP26 was like on the ground? For example, how did you spend your time day to day?
So I was in Glasgow, and I must say that there's a certain irony in it because it was actually flooded in many parts of the UK at the start of COP. So it caused a lot of travel disruption, if you remember, in those few days leading up to the start of the 2 weeks. And I was participating at a pre-COP climate finance event, and I was staying in a hotel in the middle of the Scottish countryside. But the golf course in that hotel was completely flooded. And it looked more like a small lake. You could literally row a boat across it. So I think, you know, it certainly helped focus the minds as we headed up to Glasgow. And of course, you know, if you've not been to COP before, it's more of an art rather than a science to navigate. It's a huge event that's not only held within specific zones, blue and green zones, but there are lots of events held across the city. Blue zone is where the heads of state and governments are represented. That's where they undertake the climate negotiations. And usually the blue and green zones are side by side. But of course, you know, due to COVID restrictions, due to security concerns, accessibility to these zones were much more difficult. So I think it felt, certainly from my experience, having been in the previous COPs, it was less inclusive than it usually is for obvious reasons. So our CEO, Michelle, she was speaking at several events in her role as co-chair of the COP26 Business Leaders Group. So I joined Michelle in a few events. I also participated in a panel hosted by the Better Buildings Partnership with some of our peers in the real estate sector. And we were discussing very open, transparent conversations around how we are respectively approaching our financing to the transition to net zero within the real asset space. And I must say, personally, I was very energized, re-energized, because although it is an intense time and is fairly chaotic, there's a certain sense of, you know, purposefulness in why we are there and what we're trying to achieve. And as Sonia said, you know, this is very much a collaborative industry effort. And it's important that we have an opportunity to share best practice to drive further action in this sector.
Well, thank you for that insight and for sharing that sort of vaguely apocalyptic picture of the flooding early on. I suppose an obvious follow-up question would be, did the summit meet your expectations? And to Sonia's point about what was actually accomplished, how did it compare to the famous COP in 2015 that I know you attended? Could more have been achieved this time?
I think the two COPs, it's hard to compare, and we shouldn't, because COP21 in Paris conceived the Paris Agreement. It set the framework. And COP26 is very much the stock take. It's allowing governments to reevaluate and accelerate their nationally determined contributions. And so there's much more talk this time, this COP, about action rather than what should we do, right? And how we can deliver it. So could we have achieved more in Glasgow? I think we can always achieve more, especially when we're faced with a climate crisis. But under the circumstances, coordinating almost 200 countries under a global pandemic, let's not forget global pandemic, I think we achieved more than we had expected, but still less than we really need to. So there's much more work to be done.
Well, thanks, Shwena. Let's turn to Madeline now. Shwena's just talked about action. Madeline, have the commitments made at the summit moved markets?
That's actually a really easy question to answer, because it's a straightforward no, absolutely.
Okay.
And I think to Sonia's point from earlier about the awful lot that was not said at COP, I think that is the reason why. Even if we look at arguably the most significant announcement on the coal phase down, that was obviously disappointing versus what a lot of countries in the world wanted to see. But even if we look at sort of the most exposed, the coal-heavy companies, the miners, the companies burning coal to produce power, the ones that really should be the most vulnerable to the announcements made at COP26. And in reality, the movements that we saw in those companies is nothing compared to the impact that the energy markets have had recently. So realistically, in the near term, supply and demand factors in the coal market are much, much more important than anything that was agreed over the last few weeks. The way I would think about it is markets always really, really struggle to price long-term risks. Long-term factors are much, much more difficult to analyze and value. But if those long-term factors, if we don't have the details and they lack credibility, there's just no chance that the market is going to reflect them seriously in valuations.
Right, well, that's fascinating and makes a lot of sense. And thinking about that kind of long-term view beyond COP, which sectors, in your view, present the greatest investment opportunities in the race to net zero?
I think there's a lot of opportunities across sectors, and I think depending on whether you're looking at credit or equity, there are very different ways of thinking about this. I think if you're looking for growth opportunities, and I think this is certainly a positive for kind of the potential progress that we will make over the long term, but there are an awful lot of industries, things that we might describe as traditional industrials or capital goods, where actually there's a huge amount of potential for them to be important players in the supply chain for climate solutions. So in terms of growth, I would say what we might have thought of as the traditional industrial sector actually has a lot of potential to play. And that's alongside things like technology, where I think it's already quite well flagged that's a crucial enabler for climate change, climate solutions in the long term. What I would say is that I don't think we should discount the sort of traditional sectors as well. So in credit world, utilities, there's a real sort of focus there. These are high carbon emitters, but they're also really important drivers of change. If the utilities don't get this right, we don't stand a chance as a planet. And we think that in general, obviously there are exceptions, but the industry is moving in the right direction, and Europe in particular has showed that companies can transform themselves and that they do have the commitment to do that. And we see no reason that can't be translated across the globe and for the sector to remain a really important investment base for credit investors in particular.
Right, well, and on the theme of climate solutions, Sonia, could the lack of a more powerful, collaborative commitment from countries increase the pressure on the private sector to pick up the slack? And is the private sector even able to do this?
Yeah, of course, this is a topic that I think has been very much in the focus even before COP, right? That there's a genuine understanding, particularly around the financial services sector, to get involved and obviously and to take up the responsibility to address societal issues and obviously right now, in particular, climate change. Now, I think we have seen a number of alliances. We have seen a number of initiatives. We have the Net Zero Asset Manager Initiative. We have the Net Zero Asset Owner Initiative. We have the Glasgow Finance Alliance for Net Zero. So there's a lot of collaboration already happening. And I think this will just continue, and very much along what Madeleine just said, there's an expectation that we will not only understand the problem, but we will be able to judge and assess companies and help them on their journey towards a sustainable future. Now, the question mark I think that we need to put forward and need to consider is obviously that is the listed segment. These are publicly traded companies. And, you know, there's obviously a limitation when it comes to private companies. And I think looking at the oil and gas industry, that shows where potentially the limitation is. We should not forget that the majority globally of oil, gas and coal production is done by state-owned companies and state-owned and state-controlled companies, where there's limitations of what the financial industry can do to influence. And hence, I'm coming back to what I said right in the beginning around carbon pricing, because the incentivization for the system needs to be aligned. It cannot be a difference between what you know, private sectors can do and where governments need to step in. And the carbon pricing obviously would set a universally accepted tool to move us forward. And as I said earlier, it is influencing supply and demand. And so yes, we will definitely continue with a path of engagement, but we have to understand the potential limitations, and hence, unfortunately, coming back to where we started, the need for greater collaboration in order to tackle climate change.
Right, well, Madeleine, Sonia has just touched on the theme of engagement and how we investors collaborate with our peers to drive forward change. How credible do you think the net zero pledges that you're seeing from companies are? And when you meet with management teams as part of LGIM's research and engagement groups, what are they telling you about their ability to reach these targets?
So there's a real range in terms of the targets that companies have set and how credible they are. At one extreme, it's literally, you know, we want to be net zero. We'll figure it out. We're not really sure how. And I do have a certain amount of sympathy for that. I mean, this isn't easy. And in some industries, it's particularly difficult where I think something like the airlines is a good example, where you're very dependent on technology and other sectors. So you need your suppliers to improve. And what can you really promise when it's not even under your control? So I do have a lot of sympathy in companies trying to move in the right direction and not really having it under the control. But in some cases, it is kind of, we've come out with a net zero target. We mean well, but we haven't really started to figure out how we're going to get there. So I think the engagement is extremely important to decipher the difference, because in some cases it is, you know, we've got an idea of sort of how we're going to get to this. We don't have any interim targets out yet, but this is when we think we'll be able to get to that, or, you know, these are the areas that we're focusing on. So I think those meetings that we have with companies go a long, long way to lend credibility to the targets. I mean, what I would say is that as much as some of these targets are not as credible as we would want them to be, and the plans aren't in place yet, it's certainly a positive. The number of companies that are putting out these targets for the first time with a genuine intention to get it done, and even the ones that we criticize for not really having a plan in place yet, we do think that there will be plans. And obviously we need to keep on top of this stuff, and alongside the investment stewardship team, we need to make sure that we're pushing companies to deliver on what they've said they will do. But I would say certainly the progress is positive. People are taking this stuff seriously, which can only be a good thing.
Good. Okay. So some room for comfort and even optimism there. Xuan, What were the key takeaways from the conference for real asset investors?
Well, I want to pick up on the point that we've just been discussing, which is on engagement. So we are, we think that engagement with our occupiers, basically in the buildings that we own and manage, are absolutely essential in our transition to net zero, as they, almost half of our portfolio of buildings are directly controlled by our occupiers. So it's really in our interest to engage with them and collaborate in partnership around a decarbonization plan. So having, mandatory disclosure, and not just what's regulated or coming down the sort of regulatory train, but also sort of the awareness, the general sense of awareness and interest to figure out what does net zero mean for my business, allows us as a landlord to actually have very informative conversations with our tenants. And that will really help in our efforts to tackle and jointly address the scope 3 emissions in our portfolio. So we are very encouraged by what's happening there, and that will really help in our engagement. Now, I was also very pleased, I must say, to see that there was a lot of focus at COP on real assets. And in fact, for the first time ever, on the 11th of November, the second week, there was a day dedicated to cities, regions, and the built environment. And that provided really sort of a critical focus for the real estate property sector in achieving net zero emissions. Because I think, buildings, everyone knows buildings contribute up to 40% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So the sector is very much part of particularly the UK government's decarbonisation plans. So in terms of takeaways, from a policy perspective, I think one of the key initiatives that is sort of UK government's heat and building strategy that was published just before COP. It really builds on the existing government's work and its decarbonisation plans of heat in buildings. Another outcome of COP was the launch of the net zero whole life cycle, whole life carbon roadmap. And this was an industry-led initiative led by the UK Green Buildings Council, which we are a member of, and where our head of real assets, Bill Hughes, was a COP26 ambassador under the UK GBC. And this roadmap really provides a shared vision and a set of actions for achieving net zero within the built environment by 2050. And it quantifies for the first time specific emission reduction across subsectors for the built environment that need to take place, not just in 2050, but really set out plans that take place year on year. So as a real asset owner and investor, I mean, for us, retrofitting is central to our decarbonization plan. A large part of our portfolio is made of existing stock. So it's so this is about greening existing buildings. So for example, we have been, working on removing gas boilers and replacing them with air source heat pumps, for example, reducing energy demand through the plant and fabric upgrades, reusing what would otherwise be waste materials, also part of the circular economy. So, and including as well, installing solar PV to generate renewable energy on site and if possible off site. So these are very much steps that we are doing. So the takeaways from COP is really just helps to reinforce the work that we already have begun to undertake in implementing our roadmap to net zero. So we're very encouraged by that.
Right, well, thank you for talking through those important and potentially underexplored real assets implications of COP. Sonia, this is an area you've touched on a number of times just now in the call. Is a dramatic expansion of carbon pricing the answer to reach the Paris and now Glasgow objectives, whereby the value of so-called dirty assets is slashed?
Yeah, I think yes, the answer is yes, as we said, and it is helping to all participants to understand the necessary behavioral change, and hence, you know, raising the transparency around the cost that is involved. I think that is something you could probably hear from the call already. There is big cost involved in the transition, and I think we have touched on a number of areas. It is not just the phasing out of fossil fuels. It is not just exiting coal. Everything what Xuan just says shows the breadth of necessary steps in order to tackle greenhouse gas emissions. And I think it is that that would be massively helped by a better and more transparent global system on pricing carbon in order to send the right incentive structures. Behaviors are very important, because I don't think we have a transparent enough debate yet globally around the cost for consumers, the cost for corporates, the cost for governments, in order to help the transition. And hence, again, a global carbon pricing system obviously would help to phrase that, to frame it, and to quantify what we are talking about. And hopefully would help the debate that we need for everyone to understand that obviously we need to change our behaviors. We haven't even touched on agriculture yet and all the other bits and pieces that come with it. And there is, for the time being, probably too much of an emphasis, as I said, on the fossil fuel and the energy mix transition. Although, as Xuan said, I think it was very encouraging to see how broad COP was set up and what it covered. So it clearly shows that there is a better understanding and a broader pickup, and clearly from the private sector, the responsibility as well to take this forward and to address it. So again, lots that we would have liked to see. It definitely has been progress, but not to the extent that we think is necessary at this stage. And so hopefully over the next couple of weeks and months, we will digest and see how this is taken forward. But I think for me, still the global collaboration, as we've seen from our arguments, it is the private sector alongside the public sector. I don't think either side can go it alone.
Xuan, this is quite a straightforward one. Who gave the most powerful speech at the conference?
Who gave the most powerful speech? I think, you know, if anyone's following the media throughout the last two weeks, there were lots of big, rousing speeches by many heads of states, many big VIPs with their calls to action, of course, you know, very inspiring. But personally, I think the small speeches that really resonated with me and moved me were when I was watching last Saturday, pretty much the whole afternoon, the live climate negotiations. And some of these speeches were made at the 11th hour after many, many hours, of course, following many days of tense negotiations. And I remember, well, there were a few, but I remember one in particular by Frans Timmermans, he's the executive vice president of the European Commission. And, you know, when there was still no end in sight, he said, as part of his intervention, he said, I want every one of you to think right now, at this minute, about just one person in your life. One person, only one person, who will still be around in 2050, and how that person will live if we do not stick with our target of hitting 1.5 degrees today. And, you know, it sort of just hits home. And I think Timmermans and many other representatives, particularly from those small island states, you know, in the Pacific, they are already feeling the climate severities and effects, and they were very much appealing to the hearts and minds of the many politicians in the room to put their different interests and agendas aside for the future of, you know, their own generations. And I think, to me, those were the most powerful speeches.
Right, and that does sound very powerful. It really is a life and death struggle. Well, Sonia, before we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add at this point?
Yes, please. Let me bring it back to the market context, because it is clear that we are still really at the beginning from a price discovery mechanism, as Madeline has illustrated very clearly, to understand how to think about and how to price long-term risks that are related to the climate transition and climate change. Yet it is not just the risks, there's opportunities as well. And this is something we should not forget, because the transition is transformational. We're aspiring to change the global energy system, and not just that, but consumer behaviors. We're looking at really the way we use land, the way we live, the way we consume. So there will be profound changes, and profound changes create risks and opportunities. And I think this is what really is the focus from an asset manager's point of view. It's not only understanding the full picture, but really trying to capture what will be these structural long-term themes, and doing so before the market prices and market pricing will capture it and will pick it up. And I think there will be a lot. There will be a lot more that will come out post-COP, a lot more we can digest. But I think that, to me, is the guiding principles in our understanding to take it forward, and obviously doing our part, not only in terms of our engagement, our global reach, but obviously engaging around global standards and a global framework, which hopefully will help with that journey.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating, or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous, on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording, and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties, and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions, and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, elgim.com.